This is Wine and Dine in LA with Anush, where I talk about wine in a fun and approachable way and bring you all insights of the world of wine. This is Wine and Dine in LA with Anush. Thank you for tuning in. My guest today is Emily Saladino, a writer, editor, and recipe developer based in New York. Previously, Emily was a digital managing editor of Wine Enthusiast and editor-in-chief of Wine Pair. She currently works as a writer-at-large at Wine Enthusiast, where she writes features, reviews wines, and tests and develops recipes. She also contributes to the Washington Post, Bloomberg, BBC, Bon Appetit, Food and Wine, and others. I am extremely grateful that you took time, Emily, today from your very busy schedule to chat with me. Welcome.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me.
What an exciting resume, Emily. I'm sure you have had people tell you, I want your job. But but I know, and I am pretty positive that you have worked really hard to get where you are at today. Will you take us on journey with you?
Sure, thank you. No, I think it probably sounds more interesting than it is. I want to be clear, I spend a lot of time hunched over a laptop, but thank you. It's definitely a bit of a circular path I took in order to come to my current position. I always knew I wanted to do something in food and hospitality. I love the ways that food kind of brings us together, the way that food kind of opens up your mind, your worldview, all of that. And I really like working with people. So I always kind of knew I wanted to do something in that space. I went to culinary school. I worked as a cook in kitchens for a while in New York. And I worked for tech companies. I worked all over the place, kind of circling around the space where I am now to eventually get to be a writer and editor, which at the time seemed like such an impossible goal. I wouldn't say a day passes in my life where I don't look around and think like, can't believe this happened. I can't believe I'm doing this for a living. And as I said, it's not to say it's glamorous. It's just that it's something that I did work super hard to get here. And I think a lot of people do. You put in a lot of time and hopefully it ends up bringing you to the sort of work you find fulfilling. So I got a job at Vine Pair about 6 or 7 years ago, having worked in bars and restaurants. And I worked for a big tech company, Google, for a while, doing sort of content work, doing editing work. And when I started at Vine Pair, I would say that was really the start of my wine education. I was dyed-in-the-wool food person. And so that to me was really, really cool. I'm so grateful for the opportunity to have gotten to enter the world of wine that way. When I was working in restaurants, I feel like that was a really cool way to get to taste a lot of things that I might not have come across otherwise. And then through Vine Pair and then Wine Enthusiast, I studied wine, right? I like went beyond just saying like, okay, I'm going to, understand things from a sales floor perspective and to understand things from a more journalistic place. And then that, brought me here today.
Exciting. When you were in a wine school, in the culinary school, for me, it's like, because I went to the wine school, I get mixed up. When you were at the culinary school, did you have an experience and exposure to wine then? So kind of, was it a little introduction to the world of wine, or it was strictly around food?
Oh, such a good question. We did I went to a French culinary school in New York. And so we do some wine instruction in it. I was doing culinary arts, and there are people who do, wine management and sommelier training. And that was, I was in a different program. So I did come through into wine a little bit through that. It was a really interesting thing where I thought about wine very much through the lens of food, thinking about pairing, thinking about how you would cost out wine for a restaurant, that sort of thing, as opposed to thinking about it, as a as a lens to understand history or geopolitics, or, you know, it was a very more of a food and restaurant focused approach to wine. I think that it's so interesting, people who I talk to now, like yourself, who have, you know, a wine business background, who understand winemaking from working in like viticulture. It's so interesting. There's so many ways to get into wine, right? Like, that's one of the things that makes me forever excited about it, is I feel like you can come into it as someone who's very interested in agriculture. You can come into it as someone who's very into food. There's so many pathways in.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. Same with the food. The wine and food are so connected that eventually, if you're in food, you get into the wine. And if you're in wine, you get into the food. And yes, you can approach. I think the food also, there's so many other professionals like lawyers, and just like in the wine industry too, that they just left their jobs and now they're baking bread and they love it.
Yes.
And it's so fulfilling. And again, it's like you can think of a bread just as a bread, but it's not. It's just like the wine that has so much to it, correct?
Mm-hmm. No, really beautifully said. It's true, right? Like you can sit, and there are times in my life when I have a glass of wine and I'm not like pondering soil type, you know. There's times in my life when you don't always need wine to be, you know, intellectually stimulating. You don't always need food to be something that forces you to evaluate, you know, industrial agriculture, but it can, right? It can give you these windows into the, and I think that's what's so cool, is you can take something as a very visceral pleasure, or you can take it as this kind of intellectual cue.
As a writer, Emily, how do you tell a story? And we're going to talk a little bit about food rather than wine. Story of a dish that your reader, or a wine too, that for your reader to get excited about the particular subject. Because in today's day, with technology developing so fast, yeah, attention span is lacking. I mean, for me too, it's like when I see a long email, I'm like, oh my God, I have to read through all of this. I need to process it. And writing, like, how do you capture your audience? Do you have different languages for different groups, and how do you do it?
Oh, it is a great question, $1 million question. I think, you know, for any journalist covering any topic, like, it's such a hard thing to know how to both maintain your own voice, which is important. You don't want to sound like someone else, while also speaking to existing readers of the publication and just a broader readership. You know, I think that's kind of, it's like $1 million question. It's something that I think about every time I'm writing, is I want these stories to be read, whether it's something really straightforward, like here's how to clean a wine glass, or whether it's something that's like a little bit thinky. I wrote a story recently about the roles of working motherhood in the wine business, which is obviously really complicated. And I'm not a working mother, and, you know, and I wanted to be really sure to respect everyone's points of view there, right? And so I think it's a really tricky thing to always be thinking of. You have to maintain yourself as a writer, but you're not the story, right? Like the subject matter is what you want to bring people in. And so if it's something like a recipe, or we're focusing on like a culinary tradition, I get really excited. I feel like there are a lot of different ways that I could bring someone into that story. And maybe it's as straightforward as contextualizing it in something else that's happening in the world, right? Like taking it outside of food for a second. Or maybe it's starting right in there and being like, everyone you know is cooking with garlic scapes. What are you supposed to do with them? You know, like it's finding whatever kind of suits the subject matter the best, and being honest to that. I think we've all read things that just feel so forced, you know, where you're like, yep, trying to squeeze a recipe into a different story. You know, I think you just kind of have to be true to your subject matter, to yourself as a writer, and hope that people meet you there. And I think they do. I think your readers, you know, I think readers are intelligent, and I think they find stories that do, as I say, you know, the turn of phrase people use is they pass the smell test. It smells right. It doesn't smell off, right? It smells true. And I do, I think that people are, you know, they're very intelligent. As you said, the digital space is so competitive. There's not we don't lack for options in it. And I think that's kind of all the more reason to be true to yourself.
You have exactly nailed it. You have to be true to yourself in writing, in making wine, in baking, in cooking, mm-hmm. because that's what people want. They want and they feel it. So they, I was reading the article, Wine Enthusiast, that you just mentioned, and I didn't realize that it was your article. So I read it because I'm a mother mm-hmm. and I am working and I'm in the wine industry. So naturally I saw the title and I just consumed it and it resonated on so many levels with me. And I read it and I'm like, who wrote this article? That's Emily. Oh my gosh, I love it.
Oh my gosh, thank you. That's so lovely to hear. But no, it is really funny. Also, I do think when you do read something by someone and then you wind up like either meeting them or you and I have already met, but you're like, oh, I'm going to talk to her later. You know, it's a really interesting thing, right? Because I think that there's media can be really politicized and people want to talk about, you know, media is doing X and media is doing Y. And like, these are human beings, individual people. And it's such a bizarre thing. I think that it happens a lot in the digital world. You know, we can all kind of be avatars. We can all be an email address, but we are also all like, you know, we're also all out there in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many follow-ups on what you just said earlier that I wanted to also talk a little about. You said something about the garlic. That's the, you know, how does this food crazes happen? I remember before pandemic, it was all about, I mean, we're switching gears here, all about celery juice. Mm. And then it was kale. And then it was kelp.
Yes.
So what happens? Like, who develops a recipe or who just says, okay, this year we're trending on kelp, which I love. I mean, I love all those things. I kept drinking and I kept posting my celery juice every day. And everyone's like, did you lose weight? I'm like, I'm not doing this for the weight. I just like the taste because celery has that natural salinity. And it just like, I love it so much. What's your take on those?
I love it. First of all, I agree. I feel like celery gets like undersold. People think it's tasteless and it's not. I find it like very delicious. So I'm with you on this. It is fascinating, right? The way I do think that trends, I think you're entirely correct that food trends can feel really manufactured. Sometimes they are. Honestly, sometimes there's like, you know, pistachio board and they've got a bunch of money and they're doing a PR push. Like, I'm not saying that it's always all authentic, but I also think a lot of it times it's because we do share information so quickly due to social media, due to digital media. You know, trends travel really fast. We're all more interconnected, both in our communities, in our regions, in our country, in our world. So we're just able to share that information more quickly. So I remember like in the 2010s, like, do you remember the avocado toast thing? Like, people have been eating avocados like something else for millennia, but suddenly in the 2010s in the US, we were like, this is a big deal, right? Like things kind of, and like, I think some of that is because that was also the rise of Instagram and avocado toast is really photogenic, you know? And so I think there's like a couple of factors there that go beyond whether something is delicious, as you said, you know, and whether there might not be, I don't know if there was like big avocado behind that. I don't think there was. I think it was honestly just a social trend that spread from there. But I do, I think there can be so many different ways that these trends happen. It can feel really weird and orchestrated. But I also think there's something, you know, not to sound so Pollyanna-ish, but like, I also think there's something really nice about it because it does, I don't think I would have juiced celery if a bunch of people weren't doing it. And I do think celery's very tasty and love to make it into a juice. So I think there's good and bad to trends. You don't, you know, you don't necessarily, it's not all good or all bad, kind of like everything in the internet. Like there's parts of it that can be really great that can turn you on to, I don't think I would have ever made avocado toast with red pepper flakes had I not seen it all over my Instagram. So, you know, you kind of can take it for what it is, you know, and understand that any food is bigger than any trend, and then still get what you get out of the trend.
Absolutely. I mean, avocado toast, I love. I have a friend who has a restaurant here in Pasadena area called San Marino mm-hmm. Cafe. And mm-hmm. she has so many of those different ones. And every time I go, I love that salmon and avocado, and she just puts like some Armenian twist to it. And then she has other ones. So my gosh, as I'm thinking about it, I'm salivating. I'm like drooling. It's lunchtime.
Yeah, you all in LA have access to like the most delicious year-round avocados.
We are blessed.
Where I am in New York, where we're importing them from, I believe there's like one state in Mexico where almost all of the avocados imported to the US come in from. But yeah, in Southern California, it's so, as an outsider, it's so incredible to me. I'll just see them like those and citrus fruits just growing casually in someone's yard. What a dream.
It is. For me, like growing up in Armenia, we mm-hmm. had everything. It was seasonal for us. So mm-hmm. we didn't have strawberries in the winter. Now things have changed, obviously, because everyone is progressed. But for us, oranges and tangerines, they were, I've never had avocado till I came to US, but oranges and tangerines were only Christmas and New Year's time. And when we came here, my sister's house, she had like this overflowing giant orange, juiciest oranges in the world. It was amazing. It's so, California is so abundant and we are blessed to live here, thankful. Mm-hmm. And if you ever need any avocados, I'll gladly ship some for you. You mentioned that, you know, you said you wouldn't think about putting red flakes on the avocado toast. This brings me to the other question that I had. As a recipe developer, I can't talk anymore. How do you come up with and how do you develop recipes? Something like that inspire you, like an avocado toast inspired you, and so you're going to do something else, or you just like had a dream and then you wake up and you say, "Oh my gosh, I'm gonna do this."
Oh, I love this question. I think that. It can come where you kind of pick up on flavor combinations can come from so many places. You know, it can come from, I had a dish that wasn't quite this, but it had certain similar elements. You know, I've always thought it was funny with, as you mentioned, like the kale craze. People weren't eating a ton of other cabbages. They loved kale. And like now I feel like people are realizing like the relationships among foods. And so I think that's a lot of how I approach recipe development is thinking about food in categories, much in the way that wine professionals do, where you think about is the wine full-bodied? Is it light-bodied? You know, is it high acid? If you think about food similarly, like Sami Nosrat wrote this incredible cookbook, Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, that does exactly that, that breaks food down into select elements. And so then you start thinking like, all right, maybe it's not avocado spread on bread with red pepper flakes, but it's something else that's crispy, that's creamy, and that's spicy, right? So you're thinking about food in this kind of elemental way.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And you know, it's so it's so infinite, right? Like it kind of opens it all up to you. And so if you don't have lemon that day and you know, you don't maybe not won't have it until Christmas time, but I have vinegar, right? Like you think about things in that kind of relationships to one another and in terms of rather those relationships to one another. And that kind of makes everything possible.
So when you think about recipe, you have to make sure that all those four components are included for it to be complete. Did I understand it correctly? That is like math.
It's wild, right? I mean, I wish I could take credit for this incredibly thoughtful concept. This is Sami Nosrat. I didn't come up with this. But yeah, it is kind of interesting. Like if it's not even necessarily that it needs to have those four components, but those are the ways dishes are built. So like, you might want more salt in something. Do you know what I mean? You might want more acid in something. But if you think about all of the ways that those interplay, that will shape the finished product.
Wow, I am blown away. Emily, we have to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'd like to talk a little bit more about the recipe developing because this is such an exciting topic. But I also have a few more questions that I would like to ask. So we'll be back right after this quick break.